From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Tonight, Vice President Mike Pence will headline the third night of the Republican National Convention.
Last night, President Trump's family took center stage, including his wife, Melania, who made a personal appeal for her husband.
From the day that I met him, he has only wanted to make this country the best it can be. For many years, I watched him grow concerned and frustrated, and I'm so proud to see the many things he has done in such a short time. America is in his heart. So while at times we only see the worst of people and politics on the evening news, let's remember how we come together in the most difficult times.
The First Lady also spoke to two major challenges facing the country right now, the pandemic and the demands for racial justice. To reflect more on this, including police reform efforts in Congress, we're joined by West Virginia Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito. Senator, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Tanya.
Well, Senator, first, your reaction to Melania Trump's speech. Her positive tone was in contrast to the vision presented by other parts of the convention.
Well, I think if there's anyone who knows the president and sees day to day where his heart is and where his areas of compassion and passion are, it would certainly be Melania Trump as our First Lady. She has actually visited here in West Virginia with me to go and see victims of the opioid crisis. So I thought that it was reflected well in her presentation yesterday, and I thought she did a nice job.
We heard a lot about criminal justice reform in this convention, mm-hmm. as I mentioned. We also heard a lot about supporting law enforcement, but we didn't hear a lot or anything really about the police violence that's been the cause of the unrest that we see in many cities over the last few nights, specifically because of what happened in Wisconsin. In June, you told NPR that you do think there's racial discrimination in our law enforcement and that the law is not colorblind. Is that a belief out of step with your party?
You know, I don't believe it's necessarily out of step. I think it's a very difficult discussion for us to have. And the criminal justice reform was a major victory over two decades, I believe, of trying to get more fairness and more second chances built into our system. You know, I did a lot of investigating with our local police officers, and I, you know, asked that question. Is there racism in the department or in the policies? And basically the answer I got not so much was a blatant, yes, there's racism, but it was that we've got a lot of work to do. We need more training. That's why I joined with Senator Tim Scott to work on the bill that we put forward. So I still think this is very much something that we need to work on. And I do acknowledge it exists. And I think my party acknowledges this because we put forward a great bill 3 or 4 months ago that was unacceptable to the other side.
But what you're saying speaks to nuance. And do you believe that that's missing from this convention?
Well, I think, first of all, we're only halfway through the convention, and I think there's lots to cover. I think the first thing on a lot of people's minds is what's going on with the pandemic and COVID, and I think that's been addressed in certain areas. Certainly the nurse from West Virginia talked about the importance of telehealth. I think you're going to see more areas being hit, and hopefully with all that we see going on in this country, I think this is one of the things our party should be talking about, because I think we have plans. I think we have an empathetic view, and I think that we acknowledge that this is a deep-seated issue in our country.
I want to ask you about some of the breaks with tradition and policy. Last night, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo broke from State Department policy and gave a convention speech while on an official trip to Jerusalem. There was a naturalization ceremony at the White House with Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf giving a speech in apparent violation of the Hatch Act. Do you worry about the precedent set by this norm breaking?
You know, we had a certain way of always doing a convention with the big halls and the big speeches. So I think some of the norms are broken anyway. I'll leave the discussion as to whether this is a violation of the Hatch Act. I am sure that all of that was considered. I'm sure that Secretary Pompeo probably took great care to make sure that he had a segregated presentation that was paid for and created by the RNC. And I'm sure that all of this will be investigated if it needs to be. Personally, I think it rounds out what the president has done and presents it in just a different way.
Before I let you go, the House passed a relief bill more than 3 months ago. Republicans and Democrats still have not compromised on a new relief bill. Most unemployed people are not seeing that extra $300 of redirected FEMA money in their unemployment checks. What needs to happen on the relief bill?
Well, this has been very frustrating for me because I have a state that has been very prudent with the dollars that we've received, and we still have people that are hurting. And so our governor is applying for the additional FEMA money on unemployment, which I think is a good move on his part. And also, he's been very deliberate in how to try to help our cities and counties, because there's a portion in the new bill that would give the governors more flexibility to allow those cities and counties to replace tax revenues. And that's really important to me, and maybe more directed dollars to our cities and towns. But I just think that the bargaining, my understanding is that there hasn't been enough compromise. I'm disappointed that we can't reach a consensus here, but I'm ever hopeful, as I always am.
West Virginia Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Hurricane Laura is swiftly moving towards the coasts of Texas and Louisiana and is expected to make landfall as a Category 4 storm tonight. More than 500,000 people have been ordered to evacuate, which is, of course, complicated because of the pandemic. Ray Hawthorne is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network and joins us now. Ray, the National Hurricane Center calls this a formidable hurricane. Is it expected to strengthen further from where we are right now?
It looks like it. The storm is over warm water. The winds high up in the atmosphere are light, and it looks like it is going to continue to strengthen for several more hours. There are some indications of some stronger upper-level winds right as the hurricane approaches the coast tonight, which could weaken it a little bit, but it's really not going to be enough to prevent this from being a major, major event.
So what does that mean? What are you anticipating here? How severe could the damage be?
Very severe. So the storm surge, which is the amount of water level rise above normally dry ground, is forecast to be 10 to 20 feet above normally dry ground. And that surge could extend 30 miles inland over parts of far southeastern Texas and southwestern Louisiana. So it looks like Jefferson County, Texas, into Cameron Parish, Louisiana, could be some of the worst areas hit by this, but the surge will extend outside of that. If you think about it in these terms, that would be about the height of two average adult humans. So just really incredible surge.
And what about wind and rain?
Yeah, so forecast winds are expected to be over 100 miles per hour near and where to the east of where the center crosses. This is a very large hurricane, Jeremy. Hurricane force winds extend outward up to about 70 miles from the center, and tropical storm force winds extend outward up to 175 miles. So there are likely to be tropical storm force winds as far west as the Houston and Galveston area and as far east perhaps as New Orleans. Rainfall, we're looking at rainfall amounts between about 8 and 12 inches. There will be areas that receive 15 inches or more of rain or more, extending far inland into parts of Arkansas and also into Oklahoma as well.
One of the things that was so surprising about this storm is that it was just a tropical storm yesterday, and now we're looking at the possibility of a Category 4 hurricane tonight. As we remember, there are only five categories. Why did it gain so much strength so quickly?
Yeah, there are three primary factors. The first is the water in the Gulf of Mexico is quite warm, and that warm water extends fairly deep below the ocean surface. So that's a big part of it. Also, the winds higher up in the atmosphere have become quite a bit lighter over the last 24 to 36 hours. For hurricanes to get stronger, the winds high up in the atmosphere have to be light, and we've seen that. And the third factor is the moisture in the atmosphere. So dry air can prohibit hurricanes from strengthening. In this case, the relative humidity have come up in the middle and upper parts of the atmosphere, and that is why that Laura has strengthened quite a bit over the last day or so.
Now, you mentioned Arkansas, you mentioned Oklahoma. What are we expecting this storm to do as it continues to weaken over land?
Yeah, so the weakening will definitely take place once it gets inland. Unfortunately, the storm is very strong to start, and it's moving quickly toward the northwest at about 15 miles per hour. So it looks like hurricane force winds, Jeremy, could extend as far almost to Shreveport, and tropical storm warnings extend into parts of southeastern Oklahoma, southern Arkansas. So we're going to see wind damage and power outages very far inland from this storm. Also, lots of heavy rain and strong gusty winds moving into parts of the Tennessee and Ohio valleys as well coming up by Friday.
And just briefly, obviously the pandemic makes it more difficult to deal with this storm. What are officials saying people should do in especially Texas and Louisiana?
Yeah, your best bet is if you're asked to evacuate, you will want to evacuate. This is a severe, potentially catastrophic storm. Your best bet is going to be evacuating to a neighbor or a friend or a family member is going to be your best bet. Shelters are going to be open. CDC guidelines are going to be adhered to. But really, your best bet is a friend or a family member.
Ray Hawthorne, a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, watching Hurricane Laura. Ray, thank you.
You're welcome.
The United States reported more than 40,000 new coronavirus cases yesterday and nearly 1,300 deaths, which puts it in an unfortunate league with only two other countries in the world with numbers like that, Brazil and India. European countries are seeing, on average, fewer than 50 deaths a day per country, although COVID-19 is still spreading there. Let's check in on three countries across the Atlantic with NPR reporters Eleanor Beardsley in Paris, Rob Schmitz in Berlin, and Frank Langfitt outside of London. Welcome to all of you. And Eleanor, I'm going to go to you first because of the three countries represented here, France is the one seeing the most new coronavirus cases each day, more than 3,000 yesterday. Why is that happening?
Yeah, that's right, Jeremy. Because young people are gathering and partying, says the health minister. 60% of the new cases are in those under 40. So that's why it's happening. The health minister says they're not social distancing.
And are people in general in France wearing masks and social distancing?
They are. I think it's taken very seriously. Okay, maybe those young people who are partying are not. But you go out on the street, everyone is wearing masks. About a third of French cities have mask mandates, on the books. Not just inside, but you have to wear masks outside in many places in Paris. I walk along the Seine River, you have to wear a mask. And so it's taken very seriously. And, just this morning, the prime minister said, yes, cases are rising, but it's not a reason to panic. Even if everyone is not wearing a mask and social distancing, the majority of people are, and it's just a completely different scenario. There's sort of a feeling, there's an uneasiness that it could rise, but there's also a feeling that we can control this by doing these barrier gestures, as they're calling them here.
What is going on with schools in France? Because as in this country, it is almost time for the school year to start.
Absolutely. All schools nationwide are opening next week, and every child is expected to be back in school. France did go back in school a few weeks last June, but not everyone went. And you had to wear masks to school, but you could take them off in the classroom. Now you have to keep your mask on all day long, teachers as well as students. Everyone wants to go back to school. I spoke with a woman who was a teacher and a parent. She said, yes, it's time. They have, scenarios in place if things should deteriorate, different scenarios they can try. Like she said, if things get bad, then they would have half the class in the classroom and the other half would be following virtually from home. So they have, a backup plan. But as of next week, everybody's back in school.
And just to be clear, when you say back in school, you're talking about in the classroom, not online
learning,
not hybrid.
Physically, yes, going back to the building. No, going back to the brick and mortar building.
Okay. Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Germany is also seeing a rise in coronavirus cases, but we have heard it on this show described as a model for how to deal with COVID-19 because it's kept the numbers down. What's the situation there?
Yeah, of course, Germany received a lot of accolades worldwide in the spring for doing a good job of curbing the spread of the virus. And the country spent their summer celebrating that, internal EU borders opened over the summer. People traveled regionally. They went to the beach. They traveled to unusually empty European cities and enjoyed themselves. And the restaurants were open, albeit with social distancing rules. And it went pretty well. But then about 2 weeks ago, as Germans returned from their summer travels, coronavirus cases doubled and then tripled. At the beginning of the summer, new cases of coronavirus hovered around 400 or 500 a day. Now they're at around 1,500 a day. And of course, compared to the U.S., this is a fraction, of course. But we're seeing, you know, the highest number of new cases in Germany since late April. And schools are now back in session, which is causing a lot of concern that these numbers will just go up from here.
Yeah, I hear that your sons are, in fact, back in the classroom at this point. How's that going?
Yeah, you know, we're hoping that this lasts at least through the week. Yesterday, on their second day of school, my eight-year-old told me at the breakfast table that he had a sore throat. You know, any other time outside this pandemic, we would have shrugged that off. But now in coronavirus times, that is a much bigger deal. You know, he's okay now, but parents whose kids are back in schools are all going through the same thing. You know, as for my sons, they're back to school this week. They're required to wear masks in the hallways at school, but when they're in class, they're allowed to take them off. Their school, like many here in Germany, has given us as parents an option for them to be tested for coronavirus on a weekly basis for a small fee. And they've told us that if a child becomes sick and tests positive, they've got a quarantine and testing protocol ready to go. And from what we've seen at other schools where a child is tested positive, usually that child's class gets sent home immediately for quarantine. Then they're tested, and then the ones who test negative go back to school. But the priority here for all German schools is to keep kids in school to the extent that they safely can. But of course, that will likely be a big challenge.
Now, I know that German Chancellor Angela Merkel is going to be meeting with officials in Germany's 16 states tomorrow. Is she taking the lead on the response to COVID-19, or is it more state by state as it is in many ways in this country?
Well, it has been state by state with the Merkel administration sort of taking the lead. And I think this meeting tomorrow will mark another time where she may step in. You know, they're going to be discussing whether to reintroduce stricter social distancing and mask wearing rules for the country. You know, it's clear to everyone here that there's been a lapse in following a lot of these rules, especially from restaurants and bars. Here in Berlin, it's not uncommon to see restaurants blatantly violating social distancing guidelines. My wife and I went to a popular restaurant a couple of weeks ago, and they sat us at the same four-seater table with another couple that we didn't know. They were not wearing masks, and the restaurant wasn't bothering to collect our phone numbers like they're supposed to in case of an infection. So we ended up demanding a table outside. But you know, you see this all over Berlin. Many of these establishments lost a good portion of their annual revenue during the lockdown, and they're doing whatever they can to recoup that money. And that includes ignoring safety rules to cram as many people as they can into these restaurants. So I think what's likely to come out of Merkel's meeting tomorrow is that we'll soon see better and stricter enforcement of social distancing rules in offices, public transport, and in restaurants.
Frank Langfitt, you're outside London. Are you seeing an increase in coronavirus cases there in the United Kingdom at this point?
Yeah, it's actually very similar to what Rob was talking about. We're up to about 1,200 a day, and they've been picking up in the last number of weeks. But that's obviously, just like Rob said, much, much better than it was in April. The thing that jumps out at me actually are the very low number of deaths. Yesterday, 16. The day before that, just 4 in a country of 66 million. And of course, this was a country unlike Germany that had huge problems back in April and May and was not a model for anybody to follow in handling this. Now, the reason the deaths are so low, apparently, is there's a lot more testing. They're getting better at this. The disease has been shifting away from nursing homes to younger people and people going back to work to some degree. And then use of a steroid called dexamethasone in hospitals is actually helping cut the mortality rate. So definitely a very changing picture. And I got to say, I am very heartened to see the numbers now being a lot lower than they were in terms of deaths.
Now, what is life like in the UK at this point? You talk about people going back to work. Does it feel anywhere near normal?
No, it doesn't. And it's really interesting to listen to Eleanor and Rob about this. I ride the trains a lot. I go into London. I also travel around the country. The trains are largely empty. I was in Canary Wharf, which is one of our big financial districts in London. And, you know, you could have expected a tumbleweed to be, you know, rolling down one of the sidewalks there. It's just, it is empty. And that's another reason why I think our numbers are down, is that people are not going back to the offices. Prime Minister Boris Johnson wants them to. So does Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, for economic reasons. But people who are white-collar workers are still staying away.
Speaking of economic reasons, Frank, what is the economic concern at this point in the United Kingdom as you look ahead, especially if life hasn't gotten back to normal?
It's really scary. The government here has done a very good job in a lot of ways to pay 80% of salaries to furloughed workers, but they can't do that forever. And I think it's going to run out at some point in the fall, which is around the time that many people think we'll go into a second lockdown here. And that's where I think everybody is very worried about the economic consequences for people, the psychological consequences for people. I mean, the numbers are good now, but you know, the fall is going to be a very different environment, perhaps, for this virus. So I think people are very anxious about the next 2 to 3 months.
I just have two more questions. Rob, let me go to you with this one, because you talk about people coming back from their vacations. Are you able to travel basically wherever you want in Europe at this point? Or what kind of restrictions exist if you, coming from Germany, want to go to another country?
Yes, as a resident of Germany, I can. You know, back in June and July, most of the EU opened its eternal borders, and many people, including my family, took advantage of that and traveled throughout the region. But, you know, starting a couple weeks ago, we started seeing individual EU countries begin to clamp down in their own ways. Most countries' borders remain open to other EU countries, but they're now requiring, many of them at least, are requiring proof of negative coronavirus tests from people who are either from or are traveling from areas of Europe where there have been significant outbreaks.
And Frank, what about American visitors? Are we allowed in at this point? I was supposed to go to London in about a week or two. That's not going to happen, but could I if I wanted to?
Yeah, you could come and I couldn't see you for 14 days because you'd have to go into quarantine. And what's really happened is there have been more and more countries that UK is adding to the quarantine list. So people are rushing back from holidays or not going. Ellen and I were talking, I was getting advice from her about a quick trip to Paris, and I was watching the numbers rising and I held off booking anything. And sure enough, you know, France was put on the quarantine list here, which means you come back and you got to stay inside for 14 days.
That made France very angry. They wanted to retaliate. Yeah, I was traveling around France this summer, and it was Europe for the Europeans this summer. I came, you know, there were Belgians, Dutch, Brits, and Germans, and there were literally no Americans, no Chinese. It was a different feel.
That is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. We've also been speaking with NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin and Frank Langfitt outside of London. Very interesting to hear how things are going on the other side of the Atlantic. Thanks to all of you.
You're welcome.
Happy to do it.
Thanks, Jeremy.
American Airlines says it is preparing to cut 19,000 jobs by October when government aid runs out. United, Delta, Southwest, and Spirit have also warned of coming layoffs and furloughs. Recall that the federal government has pumped billions into the airline industry, which has, through no fault of its own, lost most of its business because of the pandemic. Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now. And Seth, wasn't part of the deal when the airlines got that money that they were supposed to keep the employees on the payroll?
Yeah, they got about $25 billion in grants, Jeremy. There were strings attached, and the biggest string of all was that they had to keep everybody employed through September 30th, at least no involuntary layoffs or furloughs. A lot of people have left voluntarily, taking the carrot of some generous buyout offers. Well, September 30th is coming, and as we all know, no broader deal. This would be part of bigger congressional action. And nothing yet to help the airlines or their employees.
Well, and you wonder whether this is a negotiating tactic to say we're going to lay all these people off so that Congress actually does. And remember that the House has passed a package that would include help for the airlines. The Republicans that control the Senate have not agreed on anything. But do you think that that's what this is about? Try to get more aid from Congress in the next month?
Well, that's certainly part of it. It's also true that there will be a lot of furloughs. I mean, they're not bluffing. They have far more employees right now than they need to meet the highly reduced demand that's out there for air travel. So American Airlines, by saying 19,000 people are going to lose jobs. And by the way, Jeremy, that's on top of, I think 23,000 that took voluntary, either permanent buyouts or temporary leave come October 1st. And that they say is now a real number. We talked a couple months ago about airlines warning of even bigger numbers, but at the time, you know, United theoretically up to 36,000 people. This apparently is really 19,000 people who, absent any action, are going to be out of work come October 1st.
Now, Politico reported this morning that White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said President Trump could take executive action to help the airline industry. What could he do?
Well, it's hard to understand how you could order them to keep everybody employed without also giving them the tens of billions of dollars that they would need. And it's hard to imagine how you could do that without congressional action. On the other hand, Jeremy, it was hard to imagine how you could extend unemployment benefits through simply executive action. And of course, President Trump did that earlier this month. So who knows what they have up their sleeve. But at this point, just sort of general promises to do something, very unclear what that would look like. And airline unions have expressed skepticism that there could, in fact, be any meaningful help without congressional action.
And just as we ask you every time, how is airline demand at this moment?
It's well off its lows, but much closer to the lows than the highs. In fact, a pessimistic sign, every Sunday, Sunday's usually the busiest day of the week, we had been setting new records when you look at the TSA throughput numbers, people passing through checkpoints. Mm-hmm. And it would go up just a bit. But finally, this past weekend, when I took a look at the numbers, sure enough, this past Sunday was just a bit worse than the previous Sunday. 10 times better than back in April, but closer to those numbers than to the old ones.
That is Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
On any given day, you're probably thinking to yourself or to others, what will my life and the chances for immunity against coronavirus look like in the future? Well, in her latest piece, Four Scenarios on How We Might Develop Immunity to COVID-19, STAT reporter Helen Branswell spoke with experts on what they predict for the next few months and years, and she joins us now. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Tanya.
Well, you asked a number of experts to map out scenarios of how we might come to coexist with this threat. And you wanted to make a point that these are educated guesses, but they are broken down in four parts: sterilizing immunity, functional immunity, waning immunity, and lost immunity. Let's start with the first scenario, and that's sterilizing immunity. What is it?
So that's the kind of immunity that is what we associate with diseases that are kind of one and done. You can't catch them a second time. If you have that kind of immunity, you can't be reinfected with something. And so I wanted to find out for starters, whether that is a scenario we might be looking at in terms of COVID-19. Unfortunately, viruses that infect through mucous membranes of the nose and the throat typically don't induce sterilizing immunity. You know, when you think about all the different kinds of viruses that cause colds, or influenza for that matter, I mean, we can contract these things multiple times over our lifetime. And so the experts I spoke to felt that that really is not likely to be the scenario for most people, although one of the experts I spoke to said he thought that some people might have sterilizing immunity.
Mm. That's interesting that some people might actually have this. There's so much to learn about this and how our individual bodies and makeups work when faced with a virus like this. But there's one observation about sterilizing immunity as well, that if an infection doesn't trigger it, then a vaccine may not either. Can you explain that?
Right. So, there are multiple vaccines in development right now, as you just said. I mean, the thinking is that if our immune systems can't learn to develop complete immunity to respiratory viruses, then probably vaccines can't deliver that either. That doesn't mean the vaccines won't be useful, though. You know, as long as they are safe and effective, they could be very useful. But what they might do is turn a disease that can cause severe pneumonia or death into something that causes a cold. So, even after we're vaccinated, there's a potential that we could still contract the virus, but that our immune systems would kick into gear so quickly that the symptoms would be very mild or almost, imperceivable. And, the question would be, would we have virus in our upper airways and would we spread it to other people? That's still unclear. But, the notion that you could have a vaccine that would protect, 100% of the time is unlikely in this circumstance.
Okay. The next case scenario is functional immunity, and this is a more realistic scenario. What could that look like?
So I think we're actually starting to see that now. As you will have heard this week, there are reports of out of Hong Kong, out of a couple of places in Europe, where research groups are saying we have definitively confirmed a second infection in somebody who was previously infected. The Hong Kong case is a good example. There was a man who had COVID-19 in March. He had very mild disease, only 3 days of symptoms, and he was hospitalized because they were hospitalizing all patients there to observe them, but he was not, you know, severely sick. He recently traveled to Europe, and on his way back to Hong Kong, he was tested. He tested positive. He had no symptoms. And that's what people think functional immunity might be like, that you could contract the virus again, but that your immune system would remember it really rapidly and produce enough of an immune response very quickly that you would either have almost no symptoms or, you know, very, very mild symptoms, and that you might not even produce enough virus to transmit to other people. So if functional immunity actually does exist, there's a possibility that as more of us acquire it, either through infection or vaccination, that there might not be as much COVID-19 spreading because, you know, there'd be fewer people contributing to the spread.
Mm-hmm. The third is waning immunity, which is very similar. It's a variation of what you're just talking about, of functional immunity. Can you explain the distinction between this possibility?
Right. So the way that one was described to me is effectively similar. You know, your immune response might wane. You know, they've been measuring antibodies to try to see how long antibodies are lasting. And you might get into a scenario where there was a measurable decline of antibodies, but that on re-exposure, again, your immune system would remember this threat and would kick into gear. Again, you might have some illness, mild illness, and you might be able to transmit. And that's really where the big difference is there, that there might be more transmission going on from these mild cases, but they would be mild. I mean, one of the points that several people made to me is they don't think people will be as severely ill on a second time, a second infection, as they would be on a first. That really, you know, if these predictions are right, you know, your first bout of COVID-19 might be your worst bout of COVID-19.
The last scenario is lost immunity. How probable is this scenario that we lose all immunity over time?
You know, the good news was that none of the people I spoke to thought that that was likely at all. That it doesn't happen. They don't think that, and everything they've seen so far about the way the immune system responds to this this pathogen makes it look like lots of other pathogens, that, you know, we do develop immune responses to it, and they do not think that, you know, most healthy people would, you know, run the risk of having sort of their blackboard wiped clean at a point. I mean, conceivably, somebody who becomes immunocompromised might be in a bit of a difficult situation. But in general terms, for most people, this isn't a scenario they think we would face.
I mean, over time, then, does this kind of speak to almost to the first one about sterilizing immunity? It's not the same, but our systems might know how to deal with it. It become kind of like the fifth human coronavirus to cause common colds kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, when there are four human coronaviruses that do cause common colds, they all came into humans from animals at some point in history, but none of them came recently. And so we never observed what happened when, you know, one of these things first started infecting people. It's quite conceivable that they did something similar to what's happening now, but it was before the age of virology. So, you know, we just don't know. You know, the thinking really is, through vaccination, our immune systems will learn how to cope with this new thing, and it will just not be as severe a restriction on us going forward. That's not to say this is going to be quick, because, you know, the vast majority of the world has not yet been exposed to it, and vaccines aren't yet ready. And when they are, it's going to take a long time to vaccinate billions of people. But over time, this will not be the threat it is now.
Is that the big takeaway here after talking with all of these experts who are really deep in studying this COVID-19 and where we're headed to in the future?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I it's been a long year, as everybody listening will know. And I actually found writing this piece quite heartening, because, you know, there's a lot of bad news that's associated with COVID-19. But I came away thinking, okay, you know, yes, this is a rough period, but it's not going to be like this forever. And we will learn to coexist with this virus.
That's Helen Branswell with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today, Helen.
Thanks for speaking with me.
The pandemic is making it harder for families to put food on the table. According to Feeding America, the nation's largest hunger relief organization, 1 in 6 people may experience food insecurity this year. That's up 17 million people from this time last year. But groups across the country are taking to the fields to address this growing need to pick and distribute fresh produce that otherwise might get left behind. From member station KCUR in Kansas City, Suzanne Hogan reports.
The sun is just starting to come up over the horizon. We're standing in the middle of a cornfield in eastern Kansas, and Zachary Calloway is giving a demonstration on how to glean corn.
So the top there is a little small, but once you get down a few rows, you can see it gets pretty good.
Okay.
And so that's where, like, a kitchen or a pantry, just chop it right off there and it'd be fine.
Gleaning is the act of harvesting leftover crops, the stuff that doesn't get picked for whatever reason. Maybe a machine just didn't get to it. Maybe it didn't make enough economic sense to harvest it because of changing markets. Or maybe it was just too small or ugly to try to sell. In this particular cornfield, there is a lot of unpicked corn to glean.
And it's as simple as that. And then you'll do that hundreds and hundreds of times. And that's how we'll get 1,600 pounds of corn.
Calloway is right. He and a group of about 10 volunteers wearing masks and spread out distantly between the rows spend a few hours twisting corn ears off of stalks hundreds and hundreds of times. And by the end of the morning, they've got a van full of corn that they'll distribute to nearby pantries and community kitchens.
It's kind of a no-brainer. It's a win-win across the board.
Zach Calloway is an organizer for the group After the Harvest. It's an organization that gleans for farmers and gardens across the Kansas City area. This isn't a new concept by any means. Humans have been gleaning for centuries. And even before the pandemic, gleaning groups across the nation were doing this work as a way to address food waste and hunger. But Calloway says the need to glean now is even more critical.
Basically, every pantry, every kitchen, every organization that we talk to has expressed that their client base has grown.
Kansas City agencies have increased their food distribution amount to record levels. Before the pandemic, 300,000 people were at risk for hunger. But that number is now up by 100,000 people. That includes 1 in 4 children in the community. To address this growing need, After the Harvest has been regularly calling on the Veg Squad, folks like Mary Dees.
The Veg Squad, the Vegetable Emergency Rescue Squad.
The squad is a group of mostly retired volunteers who make themselves available any day to do emergency harvests.
All the ugly food goes to waste, and there's no excuse for that, because it tastes the same.
They'll come out and rescue produce after high winds, hailstorms, heavy rains. Basically, they'll help in any situation to keep fresh produce from being wasted.
My mother always said when I was a little girl, in this country, no one should ever go hungry.
According to the national gleaning group, the Society of St. Andrew, 85 billion pounds of food have already gone to waste this year, and counting. It's a number that just doesn't make sense to people like Sarah Caldenberg, who works at the food pantry Cross Lines Community Outreach, a social service agency in Kansas City, Kansas.
I think gleaning is kind of a way to say, like, there are solutions. There's actually food in our country to feed these people.
The gleaned produce they get from After the Harvest is the main source of fresh produce they distribute to their clients. They're feeding twice the number of people they were a year ago because of the pandemic. Carrie Faybrake is a regular here at Crosslands Pantry.
I eat a lot of things that's in the wilderness.
She's homeless and says being able to count on the non-perishable items and the fresh produce she gets from here is a huge help.
Thank you. God bless you both.
Yeah, no problem. Have a good day. Thank you.
Beyond the canned goods and bread, her pack is stuffed full with tomatoes, carrots, a watermelon. And she has a plastic bag full of peppers that, after the harvest, gleaned just yesterday at Richcraft's farm an hour north from here.
You know, they'll take a pepper that had a little wormhole in it or it had an imperfection. They'll take that and thank you for it, and away you go.
Kraft gave up trying to make money on his small, imperfect peppers years ago. He says offering his crop up to be gleaned gets at the root of what growing food is really all about for him.
Instead of just throwing it away, they'll actually take it and eat it. And that's pretty cool. I like that.
After the harvest has already gleaned over 800,000 pounds of produce this year, including Richcraft's peppers. They say as long as there's extra produce out there and hungry people, there's gleaning to be done. For Here and Now, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
Well, Tanya, the political conventions remind us that broadcasting has changed a lot because of the pandemic. The same goes for radio listening habits, which means we have some people tuning into our show for the first time. So if you are one of them, welcome.
Yes, welcome. We're here every day bringing you the latest with the resources of NPR, the BBC, and reporters in public radio newsrooms throughout the country. We're a team of thousands of journalists working to keep you informed, and we're supported in part by listener donations. So thank you.
Yes, thank you. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.